The Iron Republic by Richard Jameson Morgan, an adult brain audiobook production read to you by Graham Dunlop. Preface: Florida Magazine, January 1902. With this number begins the remarkable narrative of Mr. E.W. Barrington entitled The Iron Republic. It may be unnecessary for the magazine to disclaim any responsibility for the truth of this extraordinary story. The writer claims to have absolute and demonstrable evidence of the truth of the article on board his vessel now lying in Tampa Bay, but we have not had the opportunity to inspect these proofs. It is only fair to Mr. Barrington to say that he invites the public to come aboard his ship and see for themselves. Either as fact or fiction, it is a rare story and presents an ideal of society and government that will make the average reader long to be a citizen of the newly discovered Iron Republic. Chapter 1. Dear Sir, since the visit of your representative to my vessel, I have thought over the matter and decided to respond to your invitation to give an account of my strange adventures for the benefit of your readers. I write the narrative for your magazine because you have been kind enough to ask for it and because your interest and consideration is in marked contrast to that of other editors who have treated me with positive discourtesy, refusing to accept the statement of my experiences seriously. I am well aware that much of what I shall relate will appear incredible, and doubtless the whole story will be set down by many as a purely fanciful creation, like the fictions produced by Bellamy and other theorists within the past few years. About this matter, though I give myself no concern, as the many incontrovertible proofs, documentary and otherwise, which I have on board, will, when presented to the proper authorities, receive the recognition of the government in due and proper form, as also that of geographical and scientific societies the world over. I regret that my narrative proved, and demonstrated as it will be, must unsettle scientific theories and make it necessary to reconstruct some of our schoolbooks. But while this will result in temporary inconvenience and shake the faith of some of the dicta of science, upon the whole, the benefit will far exceed the injury. It is well to have our scientific theories unsettled every now and then, or we would become fossilized and arrogant like the bigots of the Middle Ages, and oppose any further advance in knowledge. It is unnecessary to say that after my narrative has been accepted, the zetetic theory of the Earth as a plane will have to be recognized and the geographies made in conformity therewith. In writing this history of my adventures, I wish it distinctly understood that I make no pretensions to literary style or ability, and my account will probably be crude and faulty in many respects. My only effort will be to tell a round, unvarnished tale true in every particular, for I realize that it is only in its truthfulness that the story can be of any value. A man whose literary efforts have been limited to lawyers' briefs few and far between, and whose supreme and most extended written effort was a spread eagle thesis on the science of politics at the conclusion of an uneventful college career, cannot be expected to be a model of literary excellence. But to come to my story, in the autumn of 94, I was enjoying a comfortable practice in a flourishing county town in one of the great states of the Middle West. I say comfortable practice because it was one that entailed very little work and gave me plenty of time to devote to society and politics, for the latter of which I had always felt a strong predilection. My father had achieved some distinction as an officer in the Civil War, and afterwards rose high in the politics of his state. It was the opinion of many that, had he entered the arena of politics at an earlier period in life, he might have risen to the very highest office in the nation. It has always been my desire to emulate his political career and the prestige of his name with my strong inclination for public life gave reasonable promise of success. Modesty forbids the mention of other reasons, though I already enjoyed some reputation as a speaker and was regarded by politicians throughout the state as a titer and a coming man. I had adopted the profession of law as nearest allied to politics and a brass plate bearing the name of J. Edward Barrington, attorney and counselor at law, adorned my door, though I was known in political circles as Ned Barrington and a live wire. There was no great demand for my professional services, and I was not displeased that my social and political popularity far outshone my professional fame. The reader will understand my position when I say, by way of explanation, that I was not dependent upon my profession for support. My father, who died during my last year in college, having left an ample fortune for a young man of my steady habits and inexpensive tastes. And so, at the time my story opens, I may say without offensive egotism that I was rather a promising young man of 24 with a clear conscience, infinite digestion, and, I say it modestly, a fair share of good looks. I was a member of the Young Men's Christian Association, president of a flourishing literary club, and had been for the year past a chairman of a Republican executive committee of our country. I was also a leading spirit in a local temperance society and was supposed to have considerable influence with the better elements of society in the town and county. I'd never been a candidate for any office, but was a worker in my party, content to wait for my time. I am thus particular in these uninteresting details because on them hinge the events that changed the whole course of my life and gave me an experience that will, in all probability, make my name as familiar in future generations as that of Galileo or Columbus. The campaign of 94 was a particularly heated one. Fatty Burkett, a notorious dive keeper, had been nominated by the Republican Party as the candidate for Congress from our district, and a wave of indignation swept over the country. Meetings were held, several of which I addressed, and this action of the party was condemned on all sides. The district was a Republican by a large majority, but many lifelong Republicans declared that they would never vote for such a candidate. The Democratic Convention had nominated Buck McGee, an expired fighter, of a reputation so unsavory that the alternative of voting for the opposition candidate was not to be thought of. One evening in September, I was sitting before a comfortable fire in my library reading the evening paper, when my office boy announced a party of gentlemen. Supposing it was some members of the executive committee come to talk over the political situation, or a party of friends to enjoy a rubber of whist, I had them ushered in. To abbreviate this part of my story as much as possible, it transpired that these gentlemen were members of the Democratic Committee and came with a proposition to cast the bulk of their party vote for me if I would permit myself to be brought forward as an independent candidate. They pointed out that the respectable element of the Republican Party demanded a candidate that it could vote for, and that with this vote and the support I would get from the Democratic Party, my election was assured. It is not necessary to dwell upon the details of that conference. Suffice it to say that the interest was so great and their reasoning so cogent that I consented in the interest of morality and good government to lead the movement. It seemed to be the providential opening to a great career, and when, in the enthusiasm occasioned by my acquiescence, the four gentlemen, who seemed to be men of wealth, shook hands with me, with each other, and pledged $1,000 apiece in support of the campaign against corruption, I could do no less than hand them a check for a like amount. This part of my narrative may be tiresome reading, but it is a part of the story, and in telling a story as in solving a problem, there is nothing like having all the factors stated at the beginning. I will pass over the exciting events of that campaign, the speeches I made, the letters received, commending, warning, threatening even. The abuse heaped upon me by members of my own party is all part of the political history of the district. Up to the last week of the campaign, it seemed that my election was certain. A few days before the election, I was waited upon by a committee of workers with a letter of introduction from the chairman of the Democratic Committee, which stated that the support of these gentlemen was absolutely essential to my success at the polls. After reading the letter, I turned to the party, which had remained standing, and asked what I could do for them. taking the stub of a cigar from his mouth and squirting a lot of tobacco juice on my carpet. The leader, a big-nosed Dutchman, made two or three awkward attempts to speak and finally blurted out something like the following.
"That's all right, Captain. You don't wants to get left at der ballot box. Gut? I'd takes monish der make der meerdraht. See? We will give you der support of der saloon keepers for $10,000, which but gets you in Congress where you can makes it back on one vote. See? You puts up der 10,000 ter swing der vote and der goes to Congress. You don't put up and stays your home. And now which is it?"
And replacing the cigar stub in his mouth and putting his arms akimbo, he looked for the world like a fiery fat jug with a handle on both sides. To say that I was astonished does not express it. I was utterly dumbfounded. The appearance of the man in my house had been an insult, and when the vile proposition was made, it was more than I could endure, and without standing on the quality of my English, I turned them summarily out of doors. The balance is soon told. The Democrats voted solidly for their candidate, as it was intended they should. And as I drew about 50% of the Republican vote, a Democrat was elected to Congress for the first time in the history of our district. I learned afterwards that if I had paid the $10,000, it would in no wise have affected the result. The money I did advance was not used in furthering my candidacy at all. And the whole scheme was a device to divide and defeat the Republican Party in the district. The morning after the election, I was the most universally hated man in the state. I was abused, ridiculed, cartooned. Lifelong friends turned their backs upon me as a man who had sacrificed principle and sold himself in the vain hope of gratifying an inordinate political ambition. Some of those even who had supported my candidacy shook their heads dubiously and said there had been selling somewhere. This, with the natural mortification I felt at having been used as a cat's paw and defeated, thus cutting off prematurely my anticipated political career, made existence a burden, and I determined to leave forever the scene of my disgrace. But where could I go? My name was familiar from one end of the country to the other, even my features from a half-page cartoon in a New York paper, representing me as a cat's paw pulling out of the fire a most self-satisfied-looking chestnut, which revealed the countenance of the successful Democratic candidate. After some bitter reflection, I decided to convert my property into money and purchase a vessel large enough and strong enough to bear me beyond the confines of civilization, for only there did I feel that I could escape from the scorn of my fellow men. My eventful voyage, my discovery of the Iron Republic with its remarkable government and industrial conditions, my residence on this hitherto unknown continent, and study of its wonderful advancement in civilization and the arts of life, I will give an account of to the best of my ability in this narrative, which I trust may be as interesting as it is true. In the meantime, the people of Jacksonville are welcome on board of my vessel at all times, where they will be at liberty to inspect the many articles of interest which I brought from the land which lies beyond the ice barriers of the Antarctic Circle. Chapter 2. As soon as possible after the disastrous termination of my first and last political campaign, I turned everything I had into gold and, going down to New York, bought the fine vessel which now lies in this harbor, somewhat the worse for wear, but still staunch and seaworthy. I shipped a good crew and a captain who had spent 20 years of his life playing hide-and-seek with icebergs as master of a whaler. My intention was to go on a 3 years' cruise into the Arctic regions and probably remain there, devoting the remainder of my life to the good of those isolated people, running the ship back and forth to the port of some civilized country. After a conversation with Captain Brent, however, I changed my plans and decided to go south instead of north. My reason for this was that Captain Brent had done all of his whaling in southern waters and was familiar with every piece of terra firma from the Straits of Magellan to Kerguelen's Land, and knew nothing whatever about the Arctic regions. And inasmuch as my object was to get away and as far away as possible from the haunts of civilized men, I readily agreed and drew the papers for a 3 years' cruise to extend as far south as I should desire, open water permitting. On the 17th day of June 1895, having on board stores for a 3 years cruise, $50,000 in gold coin in an iron safe in my private cabin and a picked crew, I sailed out of New York Harbor, literally shaking the dust off my native country from my feet and carrying a lighter heart than I had for months past. It is not necessary to draw out and magnify the incidents of this voyage. There are writers, W. Clark Russell, for instance, whose business in life it is to describe sea voyages. The chief interest in this story must lie in what was accomplished by the voyage and not the voyage itself. In my cabin with my books, under an awning, on the poop with Captain Brent, who was extremely well informed for a seaman, or making myself at home with the sailors before the mast, every hour was pleasantly employed. Winds were very favorable considering the season of the year, and we drew down rapidly towards the tropics. On the 10th of August, we crossed the equator, and I brought out half a dozen bottles of wine and a box of cigars, and had the sailors, who were all smart American boys, aft. About the last of September, we passed the Cape and began to realize that we were indeed leaving the habitable world and passing into a solitude of waters whose southern boundaries were unknown. And here our real voyage began. There is a fierceness and blackness in these wild waters below the Cape that those familiar only with the ship courses of the Atlantic and Pacific can form no conception of. Wilder and wilder grew the sea as we drew southward, but Captain Brent was an old navigator, and I feared the terrors of the whole Antarctic region, not so much as a single cartoon in American newspaper. In 151 days after leaving New York, we encountered ice, and a month later, we were sailing along the southern ice barriers that towered like sapphire cliffs as far as the eye could see in either direction. It was now summertime in these regions, and Captain Brent said that he had never seen the sea so clear of ice. Whales spouted in every direction, and seafowl by thousands sailed above us or perched among the icy precipices. The grandeur of the scenery about us at this time baffles description. As we sailed leisurely east by south, there was a wall of ice on our right, ranging from 50 to 300 feet high, giving out with a splendor which no artist may portray. The gorgeous hues of the rainbow, in some places the cliffs overhung, making great grottos in which the largest ship might float. On the 23rd of December, we sighted the lofty summit of Mount Erebus, the only volcano so far as is known in the Antarctic regions. On the 29th, turning a spur or promontory of ice that jutted out many miles into the sea, we ran into a great cove landlocked, or rather ice-locked, where the water was smooth and where the cliffs shelved up gradually from the water's edge, reaching back and up many thousand feet to where the opal-tinted ice shaded off into the dull gray and brown of the rugged and barren rocks of Mount Erebus. Standing on the deck of the ship and looking up the wide and irregular incline of ice that extended from the water's edge up to where the rugged sides of Mount Erebus showed above, I enjoyed one of the grandest sights ever looked upon by man. The sloping incline was broken into hundreds of terraces, down which the melting snow water dashed in innumerable cascades and poured into the sea, making great banks of fleecy foam that froze and floated away, as it were, gossamer icebergs. As I gazed up at this terraced incline from the placid sea to the towering heights beyond, it looked like a marble stairway leading up to heaven, so broad and grand in its mighty sweep that all the tribes of earth might mount upon it. It was a picture that Milton or Homer might have used in their immortal epics of gods and angels. The water lapping over terraces and leaping downward here and there was as white as milk and in the distance looked like gauzy draperies of lace, and down spread on the mighty stairway, as archangels might spread them for gods to walk upon. No grander sight was ever looked upon by seer or prophet in the most enraptured vision. This phenomenon, so remarkable in these regions of ice and snow, where the temperature is always below the freezing point, was caused by the heat of Mount Erebus melting the ice and snow that climbed up the sides for thousands of feet. The volcano was in a mild state of eruption, and I suppose the hidden fires on this side had melted down the ice walls and worn away this great thoroughfare to the sea by pouring down a continuous flood of water. The ascent looked accessible, and I determined to make an effort to reach the Great Cone and have a view of these unknown regions. We had Christmas dinner on board, after which Captain Brent read from his manual a service suitable for the occasion, and perhaps with the exception of myself. Everyone on the ship yearned for home and its associations on this day of universal joy and gladness. The boys looked blue enough until I brought out a great bowl of punch, but that soon brought them back to a state of warmth and merriment. A fine carouse the fellows had had when I proposed to lead a party to climb Mount Erebus next day. Everyone volunteered to go, and my own difficulty was in making a selection. I chose three of the hardiest, and the next morning, with rubber boots reaching to our waists and so wrapped in woolens that we might pass a night without harm, if we could get above the ice and water, we lowered a boat and pulled into the shelving beach, taking along an extra crew to carry the boat back to the vessel. Laying our boat alongside the ice, we had no difficulty in effecting a landing, as the water was quite smooth, and in many places we could easily step out on the ice. Synopsis of former chapters. Mr. J.E. Barrington, a brilliant and wealthy young lawyer and politician of one of the great Middle Western states, is duped and sold out by the professional politicians in his campaign for Congress. And chagrined and embittered against his country and the entire human race, he converts all of his property into gold and, going to New York, purchases a vessel with which he sails down into the Antarctic regions, with the intention of devoting his life and means to polar explorations, or finding some isolated country beyond the pale of civilization, and out of the track of sea travel where he will be lost to the world. Chapter 2, Continued. To my surprise, I found the ascent less difficult than I had expected. Picking out the easiest ways and keeping as much as possible out of the water, we reached a secondary cone or summit about two-thirds of the way up as darkness, or rather the twilight of the Antarctic night, closed in upon us. The surface was quite dry and warm, and I never spent a more comfortable night in these frozen regions than on this lofty peak of Mount Erebus. Getting under a ledge of rocks that sheltered us from the wind, which cut like a knife, we slept soundly without fear of mice or bedbugs. That night we witnessed the grandest display of the Aurora Australis that perhaps any human eyes ever looked upon before. We were 8,000 or 9,000 feet above the sea, and the luminous bands of purple and orange colored light seemed to spring up from all around us as they spread towards the zenith, and then dipped umbrella-shaped to the horizon. The white desolation of this frozen world was suffused with supernatural glory. As we looked out and away on the endless panorama of crags and cliffs and peaks, of what seemed to be mountain ranges below us, all deathly white in this unearthly light, it looked like the ghost of a dead world. The scene was overpowering, and after a hasty survey, we were glad to clamber down into our little gorge, out of the uncanny light, and smoke our pipes and hear each other's voices, to bring us back, as it were, to ourselves. This volcano is on the coast of Victoria Land, and in all probability, we were the first human beings who ever set foot on it. It is between 70 and 80 degrees south latitude and looking east or west as far as the eye could see, with the exception of the stairway-like slope tip which we had climbed, stretched an unbroken wall of ice. Looking southward, though, with the aid of a glass, I could plainly see an open sea, very much like that on the north, and clear of ice. I studied the situation carefully. Here was the impenetrable ice barrier that had baffled every explorer of these southern seas. All below this latitude was supposed to be a continent of ice and snow. Men had sailed down here and been dashed against this wall or had gone back dismayed. But here on the south was the open sea, which, if it could be reached, offered to the curious navigator opportunity to go. Heaven only knew where. The more I looked at that great open sea, the more I became convinced that there was a passage somewhere through the icy wall connecting these two bodies of water. We made the descent without incident, and I instructed Captain Brent to hold a safe distance from the ice and circumnavigate the entire Antarctic Circle, or find a passage through the ice. Fully imbued then with the idea that the Earth was a sphere, I suppose that this body of water on the south was simply an open polar sea surrounded by walls of ice. The next day it came on to blow a gale of sleet and snow, and we ought northward for 4 days through such a storm as can only age in the frozen seas about the South Pole. During these entire 4 days it was so dark that we could not see the top mast from the deck, though every spar and shroud was white with ice. Several times we were in dangerous proximity to icebergs, but standing to windward as we were, we could smell the mighty monsters, though we could not see them and keep away. This smell of an iceberg, as it is called by seamen, is the peculiar crispness of the air blowing over one of these great bodies of ice and may be felt for miles. The vessel was awash from capstan to wheel, and though we could carry scarcely more canvas than would give us steerage way, her lee scuppers were most of the time dragging through the hissing brine, and it was absolutely necessary for every man above deck to lash himself to the rigging to keep from being washed overboard. Cooking was out of the question, and for 4 days there was no fire in the cook's galley, our diet during that time consisting of sea biscuit and tinned food, with an occasional panicking of rum to keep up the warmth. It was a fearful time, and though we had encountered much heavy weather on the voyage, we had experienced nothing comparable with this. Indeed, Captain Brent said afterwards that in all his 20 years of voyaging in these waters, he had never passed through such a terrible gale. Only the staunchness of our ship and the skill and experience of our skipper saved us from destruction. It may not be irreverent or presumptuous in me also to feel that an overruling providence guided us through this ice-strewn and storm-whipped sea, that the great results of our voyage might be achieved. When the terrific storm subsided and the atmosphere cleared so that we could again see about us, the towering ice barriers were nowhere to be seen. How much northing we had made it was impossible for us to tell, as we had entirely lost our reckoning, heading southward again until we raised the ice wall along which we had been coasting before the gale. We shaped our course parallel to it and held on with the view of finding a passage through it, if there was such a thing. 14 days after this, during which time we encountered all sorts of weather, for there are never many days together in these seas without a wild snort of wind and snow from some direction, Captain Brent called me up from my cabin and handed me his glass, directed my attention to an opening in the wall of ice before us. Two crystal promontories jutted out into the water on either hand and between, a narrow but well-defined and open strait. We could not see through, as it was sinuous, but after observing it for some time, we could perceive by the loose ice that was floating about the mouth that a current set into it. I instantly gave directions to have the vessel headed into the strait. In vain, Captain Brent remonstrated and declared that we must be lost if we encountered an ice pack or were overtaken by a storm in this narrow place. "The wind is fair," said he, "but if we encountered an ice pack blocking the passage, as we most likely shall, we can never navigate the ship out again without more sea room." It was the first serious disagreement we had had ever since we started on the voyage, and I could not help but feel as the navigator, with the responsibility for the safety of the vessel and the lives of the crew, he was right. I begged him, though, to lay in as close as he could to the mouth of this strait, that we might examine it more closely, and on this we compromised and put the vessel's head in towards the opening, intending to heave to and claw off the shore as the wind was light and the sea comparatively calm. And here it did seem that Providence was furthering my apparently wild purpose, for when he had dropped the ship into within a few hundred feet of the opening and ordered the helm down to bring her about, the wind suddenly failed so that there was not steerage way enough to bring the vessel's head around, and we drifted helplessly at the mercy of the waves. Instantly, all was commotion. For a ship on a shore without wind is in perilous condition as a steamer with a broken wheel. The bow anchor was quickly cleared and the lead cast, but there was no bottom, and so to cast anchor would be useless. The current had now caught us, and there was nothing for it but to head straight into the opening, or be broken to pieces on the icy promontories that stood out like Scylla and Charybdis on either hand. My heart bounded as we passed between the towering ice walls, and I felt a thrill of excitement such as Columbus must have experienced when the long-looked-for Antilles lifted on his expectant vision. Chapter 3. The apprehensions of Captain Brent proved groundless. The passage was open, and though there was considerable floating ice, the current was driving it in the same direction, and we experienced no difficulty in sailing through. Indeed, it was impossible for us to do anything but go through, for after we had gotten fairly into the strait, the current was like a mighty, swift-flowing river, and had there been a fair wind to go back, it must have blown half a gale to drive us against such a tide as was sweeping through. I was convinced that this was a permanent strait and not merely an accidental break in the Great Barriers. The regular smoothness of the sides showed the effects of a continuous current and the abrasions of great masses of ice carried through by it. I say I was convinced then, but when on our return we found the passage in every respect practically in the same condition as when we passed through first, there was positively no room for doubt. I will not contend that this strait is always open, but I do maintain that it is a permanent channel through which a strong current flows, and I am certain that there is a backbone of terra firma underneath these barriers of ice, through which this passage cuts, and it is as permanent and clearly defined as the Straits of Magellan or Gibraltar. I have a theory, but as it must be elucidated in dry deductions of scientific reasoning, I will not inject it into this narrative. It is my intention, though, as soon as possible, to prepare a more elaborate work, which I am constrained to believe will be a valuable addition to scientific literature. It is probable that this passage is sometimes closed by ice packs, or the entrance may be jammed with great masses of drift ice, while beyond, the channel may still be open. With a current always flowing through from the north, it is easy to imagine that a great iceberg happening to be nearby would be drawn in. If it were large enough to fill up the passage, as many of them are, it would be firmly held there until crushed up and broken by the waves, hiding the strait and giving the appearance of a solid ice wall. Then, too, mariners in these wild sea wastes are very cautious, seldom approaching near enough to the barriers to detect this passage, even if it were open. What the depth of it is, we had no means of ascertaining. For though we spliced together all the lead lines aboard the ship, we never succeeded in finding bottom anywhere. On account of the tremendous current that set through with the ship, the log was valueless, but from close observation both going and coming, Captain Brent estimates the length of the passage to be about 25 miles. On the farther side, the ice walls and sea presented practically the same features as on this, the shining cliffs running away as far as the eye could see on either hand, while the black ocean heaved with great billows that broke with continuous thunder against the barriers or threw their spray high up into the great solemn icebergs that floated in silent majesty, too immense to be shaken by Neptune in the wildest efforts of his wrath. The sun, which had been rising but a little way above the horizon for some time past, disappeared entirely soon after we got into the open sea beyond the barriers. But when the air was not filled with sleet or snow, it was never really dark. The aurora australis, too, frequently lighted the sea with its weird, strange glow, so that it was easy for us to keep the frozen coastline in view. My object was now to circumnavigate this polar sea, sailing eastward along the south side of the barriers until we again came in view of Mount Erebus, far off to the northwest. We then headed the ship due south and soon sunk the ice-bound coast and mountain beneath the black horizon of the Antarctic Sea. My idea then was that we were in an open polar sea, ice-locked all around, and we thought to sail directly across until we reached the barriers on the opposite side, and thus obtain a knowledge of its extent. Shortly after we crossed the ice barriers, the needle became erratic, deflecting more and more every day until entirely reversed itself. The weather was fair, and we detected this by the constellations, or we would undoubtedly have sailed out of our course and turned the ship around and following the compass. For weeks after we passed through Barrington Strait, as I have been egotistical enough to christen it, we had storms, snow, and ice, and the black ocean through which we plowed was in no wise different from that which extends from Cape Horn to Victoria Land, except that we noticed less ice and met with no storms as severe as we encountered on this side, both going and coming. I will not weary the reader with the details of our long voyage in this hitherto unknown ocean. In the course of time, the sun again appeared as we drew southward. The sea became cleared of ice and the cold moderated as it does in traveling from the poles to the equator. In vain we looked for the ice barriers which we supposed surrounded us. Only the black open sea stretched on as we held our course. There were no exciting incidents, and 4 months after passing the barriers, we were sailing in open seas out of the region of ice and snow, with the weather constantly growing warmer. 2 months later, we encountered driftwood, and not long afterwards, sea fowls appeared and grew more numerous every day. They first appeared on the starboard side, and then as their number increased from day to day, including some that were unmistakably land birds, I expressed the opinion to Captain Brent that we were sailing parallel to some coast, and suggested that the ship's course be altered to make this shore. This was done, and evidences of land, such as seaweed and driftwood, became more apparent every day. My interest and excitement became so great that I could not be still a moment when awake and could sleep but little. In a fever of restlessness, I walked the deck hour after hour and scanned the horizon for land. A perfectly useless waste of energy, as a man was stationed in the lookout, who of course would see the land long before it became visible from the deck. The weather was fine, and we were evidently nearing land of some kind. As night closed on the 20th of July, an illumination of some kind was plainly visible on the horizon off the starboard bow, and the vessel's head was turned towards it. My excitement was so great that I did not go down to my cabin for supper. The illumination grew plainer constantly at 10 o'clock. The lookout at the masthead said he could distinguish what seemed to be electric lights. At this, my hopes fell. I had been thrilled with the idea of approaching an unknown land in an unknown ocean, and now it seemed that in some way we had gotten back into the beaten track of the world and was approaching a modern city. Captain Brent was of the opinion that it was one of the cities on the west coast of South America. Although it was impossible to understand how we could have gotten there, as we had been sailing south by the heavens ever since we left the polar regions. In a short time it was plainly to be seen from the deck that we were approaching a considerable city, lighted by electricity. As we neared the land, the lead was heaved constantly, and after running in as close as he dared, the captain cast anchor and waited for daylight before attempting to enter the harbor. As soon as the ship was made, snug, and everything became quiet on board, I was struck by the strange silence of the city that lay before us. Although evidently a large city and a modern one, if we might judge from the brilliant manner in which it was lighted, there was an entire absence of that roar and rumble which characterizes the modern American or European city. As a matter of fact, although we lay within a few miles, no sound of any kind came to us, and the silence was strange and weird-like, as though it was some brilliantly illuminated city of the dead. I was awakened next morning by the creaking of the winch and the rattling of the cable as the anchor was hoisted, and dressed hurriedly, I went on deck where the captain and crew were discussing the small craft that was coming out of the harbor. Even as we looked, a most remarkable boat came tearing out and pitching towards us at a rate of at least 50 miles an hour. As it came towards us, we could see only a great billow of foam and above it a covered deck, something like a ferry boat or excursion barge. When it came alongside of us, we could see that the vessel, if such a thing may be called a vessel, consisted of a long cigar-shaped hull submerged after the fashion of the American whaleback, with a superstructure raised on stanchions. On each end of this cylindrical hull were great cone-shaped screws, somewhat larger than the hull itself, and it was these that raised the billows of foam as they leaped through the water, pushing and dragging the strange-looking boat. A uniformed pilot was put aboard, and a towing hawser thrown to the men in the bow. Saluting and speaking perfect English, though with a peculiar accent, the pilot asked what vessel it was. On being informed that it was the Wanderer of New York, United States of America, he dropped his jaw, stretched his eyes, and looked altogether as upset as if he had been told that it was the Flying Dutchman.
"What land is this?" asked Captain Brent in turn.
"The Iron Republic, sir," replied the pilot, again saluting and advancing to the wheel. In response to our further questioning, he courteously stated that he was an officer on duty, that it was against the rules for him to hold any conversation except in reference to the ship, and begged us to curb our curiosity until we got ashore, when all the information we desired would be afforded us. There was nothing else for us to do, so Captain Brent turned his attention to lowering and furling the sails, which had been hoisted, and by the time everything was made snug, we were alongside the pier. As soon as we were made fast, another officer came on board, and he, like the pilot, seemed to be dumbfounded when he learned that the vessel hailed from the United States of America. After inspecting the ship's papers, he turned to Captain Brent and informed him that the circumstances of our arrival were so unusual and unprecedented, in his experience, that he would be under the necessity of conducting him to the office of the Director of Navigation. Thereupon, the captain introduced me as owner and the proper person to deal with, and the officer politely requested me to accompany him. "Sir," said I, as we passed through the curious throng that had gathered on the wharf, "will you be kind enough to tell me what country this is and in what part of the world it lies?" "This," he replied, "is the Iron Republic, and the continent on which you stand lies about as far from the frozen ocean as your own continent of America does in the opposite direction." Just here, having reached the outskirts of the crowd, he made a signal, and a man approached with a horseless vehicle and, dismounting, saluted and opened the door of his carriage. Forbearing to question further an officer of whose power and authority I had not the slightest idea, and whose extreme courtesy forbade impertinence, I took my place in the carriage and was whirled along wide, smooth streets through the heart of the city. I have remarked that though we lay just outside of the harbor and in sight of the city for some hours before entering, we heard none of that roar and rumble inseparable from cities of its apparent size among us. The reason was now plain. In the first place, the streets were all as smooth as a tennis court, and there was nothing to make a noise. There was not a horse to be seen, and it was evident from the floor-like cleanliness of the streets that they were not intended for the use of horses and wagons. On all sides were horseless vehicles of every description, from the lightest bicycles to large covered vans, all rubber-tired, whirling to and fro swiftly and without noise. I had only time to note the things referred to and to remark the strange and picturesque costumes of the ladies and gentlemen who were on the street, when my conductor drew up before a large, substantial stone building covering an entire block. Stepping down from the carriage, he assisted me to alight and ushered me into a large and well-lighted reception room in the front of the building. I noticed as we approached that a blue flag with a white star floated from the tower on the roof, and surmised that in some way the two officers with whom I had been brought in contact in the building, which we had just entered, represented the same department of government. Conducting me to one of the comfortable seats with which the room was supplied, my companion excused himself by saying that the gentleman who met me at the boat would be with me in a few minutes and withdrew. Scarcely had he passed through the door when the person deferred to Dune Inn, having presumably ridden up after us in his own carriage. Smiling pleasantly, he expressed the hope that I would be not annoyed by the little conventionalities to which I was being subjected, saying that my arrival was so extraordinary and so out of common with all the other entries made since he had been connected with the Marine, that he had no other recourse but to refer me to the head of the department. I assured him that I was under obligations for his courteous attention, that a stranger as I was and dazed by the extraordinary circumstances in which I found myself, I was in a condition to absolutely require guidance and direction. He desired me to consider myself under no restraint whatever, stating that I was being referred to the chief of the Bureau of Navigation, because he was at a loss to know how to place me on the Marine Register. Opening a door, he conducted me without ceremony into the presence of a gentleman whom he introduced as Director of Navigation and Chief of the Department of the Marine. This officer, notwithstanding his evident high position, rose and, smiling cordially, bowed and asked us both to be seated. In a few words, the subordinate explained to his superior the circumstances of my arrival and asked for instructions in certain matters pertaining for the registering of my vessel. These were given, and then the high official, with rare feeling and tact, arose and grasped my hand and welcomed me to the Iron Republic, saying that though it might lack the associations which must make my native country pleasant, it possessed advantages and attractions which he believed, from what he had been able to learn, could not be found in America. I thanked him for his cordial greeting and assured him that while some associations of my own country had been pleasant, others were very unpleasant, and upon the whole I was glad to have found my way to the Iron Republic, whatever and wherever it might be. After inquiring into the details of my voyage, in which he manifested great interest, the director remarked that the astonishment of his countrymen at my arrival would naturally be much less than mine, inasmuch as they had a very thorough knowledge of my country. It was known, he said, from the settlement of his country that the American continent existed. Indeed, that it was the attempt of a shipload of emigrants to get to America that led to the discovery of the continent on which the magnificent structure of government known as the Iron Republic had been reared. This was in 1698, and driven southward by fierce gales, the colonists, after many months of battling with storm and ice, found themselves cast on the inhospitable shores of a new world. For many years after the first settlement was made, it was supposed by the colonists that they were on a portion of the American continent. But with the development of the country, the increase of knowledge, and the researches of navigators, it was found that they had been discoverers as well as colonizers. They knew all that was known in Europe of the American continent up to the time they were so effectually cut off from the balance of the civilized world, and within the past 50 years two other American ships had drifted to their shores. When I told him how many lives had been lost and how much treasure had been squandered by America and other nations in Arctic explorations, and expressed surprise that a people so advanced in the arts of civilization as his nation appeared to be should make no attempts to establish communication with other parts of the world, but should remain so isolated for centuries, he smiled pleasantly and said he could appreciate my feelings. In the first place, he explained that the Iron Republic had never been engaged in maritime commerce to any considerable extent, even in the days when trading was encouraged, as there were no other great maritime nations to trade with. As a consequence, there was not the passion for voyaging and exploration which obtains among a maritime people. Nevertheless, some attempts had been made to get through the barriers, and as vessels had sailed away and never returned, it was supposed at the time that some of them might have succeeded in the attempt. Since the establishment of the Great Republic, though, no efforts had been made in that direction, for the reason that there was not sufficient private capital to undertake such enterprises. And from the knowledge they had of the outside world, the government did not desire closer intercourse with the older nations, as it could not possibly do them any good, and might result in much harm. This, he admitted, was a species of national selfishness. "But selfishness," said he with a smile, "is human, and is one thing we have in common with all peoples past and present." He then told me that a Captain Morris had reached their country with a ship and crew during the progress of the Great Civil War, and that some years before that an old American whaler had come to their shores. The whaler remained with them a year and then left with the intention of making his way back to America, and was never heard of again. Captain Morris, he informed me, was then in the country and, being a man of great ability, was at the head of the Government Naval College. The most of his crew, too, were still living and were established in different parts of the country. At the conclusion of an hour of pleasant conversation, the affable director touched a button, saying that it was very probable that the press had given out the details of my arrival. Speaking into a bell-shaped transmitter directly over his table, he called "Current News," and then pushed back his chair in a listening attitude. In a moment, a voice, rich and strong and distinct, answered back through the transmitter. "Current news, 8:00 to 10:00. President Wilkie's and party arrived this morning at 8:20 by the through express, making the 760 miles from the capital to Corinthus in 4 hours and 10 minutes. The president comes down to participate in the formal opening of the new temple this evening. Everything is in perfect readiness, and when the lights are turned on tonight, the people will have no cause to regret the money expended in its construction. It will seat 5,000 people, and the architects, Messrs. Horn and Jameson, claim for it the most perfect acoustic qualities of any auditorium in the Republic, except possibly the amphitheater of the Capitol. In tests made yesterday, a whisper on the platform could be heard with perfect distinctness in the third gallery. The grand harmonium has been furnished with another chime of bells, the first set having been rejected by Professor Hallam on account of defectiveness of tone. The Winter King, Churchill's last masterpiece, will be rendered for the first time tonight. Professor Hallam has announced it as one of the greatest triumphs of the musical art. As the demand for seats will be large, admission will be had by drawings commencing promptly at 12:30 p.m. No change of program as given. Senator Cromwell of the province of Urbana had an attack of paralysis this morning at 6 o'clock as he was plowing in his field and has not yet recovered consciousness. This is his second attack, and the physicians feel it may prove fatal. Senator Cromwell is in the fourth year of his office as representative of the great province of Urbana, and by his modest dignity and usefulness has made himself one of the most popular senators that ever filled the office. He was the inventor of the Cromwell Harrow and was the first to adopt the practice of dehorning cattle. Exchange reports show that 27 million diems were cancelled yesterday. This large volume of business was caused by the approaching cooler weather, which called out a heavy tonnage of coal. Potatoes and bond are not doing well, and the Bureau of Subsistence has ordered them cut 20% to encourage consumption and prevent loss. The sensation of the day is the arrival at the port of Corinthus of another vessel from America. It was brought up this morning about 8 o'clock and is a typical American ship of 250 tons. Captain Brent Master with a crew of 8. The vessel is owned by J. Edward Barrington of the United States and sailed through the barriers about 7 months ago. Mr. Barrington is at present in conference with the Director of Navigation, and it is not known what his plans for the future are. A great crowd has already collected on the pier, and Professor Morris, the well-known American author and president of the Naval College, will arrive from the Capitol on the 12 o'clock express to meet his countrymen. Special resume at 12 o'clock. The voice ceased, and touching the button again, the director turned to me. "I've not given all or anything like half what came to us as current news, but just simply a sample. I inquired if this news was being read from a daily paper through the telephone, and the director replied that it was the paper, or what corresponded to it, itself. "Do you mean to say," I asked with astonishment, "that all of the people get the news as we have just heard it?" "I mean to say," answered the director, "that several millions of people heard or had the opportunity of hearing the same voice giving out the same news that we have just listened to." "And there is no paper printed?" I asked, scarcely able to grasp the idea of such a news service. "None, except what is printed right there," pointing to a small machine I had noticed ticking on the table. "Every word you have heard is reproduced there in print and can be preserved for future reading or destroyed at the option of the patron." I stepped to the table and looked, but could make nothing of the cabalistic signs on the paper before me. "How is it," I inquired, "that you speak the English language and do not use the Roman characters as other English-speaking people do?" "We used the same letters," answered the director, "until the discovery of sound characters. Most of our books are printed in the old way, only the newest literature being printed with the sound characters." "What do you call a sound character?" I asked. "I may not be able to make you understand," said the director, "if you are unfamiliar with the development and progress of the knowledge of sound. I told him that the nature of sound as atmospheric vibrations was well understood by us and mentioned the telephone and phonograph in common use as an illustration. "Very well, then," said he. "It is simple enough. The vibrations are communicated to the machine and the machine transmute them into characters. Reproduce a sound a million times and it will make the same character every time. It is a true phonetic system and is nature's own writing." Amazed at a civilization evidently so far in advance of ours, I had forgotten the circumstances by which I was surrounded and would have questioned further, but the genial official excused himself, saying that his duties would deprive him of the further pleasure of my company at that time, but that he hoped to meet me again soon, outside of business hours and in a social way. In the meantime, I would receive the attention of the government. Pressing another button, he informed me that a carriage was ready to return me to my vessel, where in a few hours I would probably be called upon by my distinguished countrymen and other representatives of the government. Grasping his extended hand heartily, I thanked him for his kindness and returned to the wharf. As I approached, in the conduct of the same officer who had carried me from the boat, the curious crowd fell back respectfully and I passed on board. Notwithstanding, our position was one calculated to repress every emotion except astonishment. I found Captain Brent in a tremendous state of wrath, and the steward was describing the heathenish country to which we had drifted, in a flight of profanity that was positively eloquent. On learning the cause, I found that the last named dignitary had been out in the city trying to purchase fresh meats and vegetables, on which the men stood in great need after their long voyage. It seemed, though, that neither gold or silver would be accepted in payment, and so the dinner of fresh victuals that all had looked forward to so eagerly was not in sight. We were soon relieved, however, by the appearance of a van load of fresh supplies, which the vendor said was brought on an order from the Marine Office. I retired to my cabin and tried to collect my thoughts. I had been but a few hours in this wonderful country, and already my senses had taken in more, it seemed to me, than my mind could analyze and digest in weeks. I felt as if I would like to get away by myself for 2 or 3 days and think it over. Everything was so new and strange that all mental effort was directed to grasping the situation. Thank you for listening to this sample. To continue listening to this book and for access to all of our other full audiobooks, please subscribe for $7.77 per month. Go to adultbrain.ca or follow the link in the show notes. This will be a completely separate podcast with a new RSS feed and will have all the titles from this feed as well. Thank you for your help and support in bringing rare and forgotten books to audio for the world.